ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about why a plant-based diet is not only the healthiest for us humans, it's the best thing that one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Mark Reinfeld, author of The 30-Minute Vegan, Soup's On. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
More than three-quarters of the species of large land predators, such as lions, bears, and wolves, are in decline, according to a new study published last Thursday in the journal Science. Most large carnivores now occupy only a fraction of their historic ranges, and more than half are threatened with extinction. As carnivores decline, ecosystems and food chains that humans depend on for survival are unraveling. Large carnivores have already been exterminated in many developed regions, including Western Europe and Eastern United States. And the same pattern of carnivore extermination is being repeated throughout the world. Yet evidence suggests that carnivores play a vital role in maintaining the delicate balance of ecosystems. The lead researcher for this study, Professor William Ripple, an ecologist at Oregon State University, said, "Globally, we are losing our large carnivores. Many of them are endangered. Their ranges are collapsing. Many of these animals are at risk of extinction." Humans have waged a long-standing war with large carnivores that kill livestock. But the international team from the U.S., Australia, Italy, and Sweden called for a global initiative to conserve large predators. Professor Ripple and his colleagues focused on seven key species whose ecological impact has been extensively studied: the African lion, leopard, Eurasian lynx, cougar, gray wolf, sea otter, and dingo. A review of the evidence showed how the decline of cougars and wolves at Yellowstone National Park and other North American national parks led to an increase in browsing animals such as deer and elk. This in turn had a cascading effect, disrupting vegetation growth and upsetting populations of birds and small mammals. Studies of the lynx, the Australian dingo, lions, and sea otters have shown similar effects, said the researchers. In Africa, the loss of lions and leopards had coincided with a dramatic increase in baboons, which in turn are raiding farmers' crops for foods. Professor Ripple said, "We should be thinking of ourselves in the end, because if enough important species go extinct and we lose enough ecosystems, then humanity will suffer."
In a related story, the Center for Biological Diversity reports that they've joined a coalition of groups in a lawsuit to stop a state-hired bounty hunter from exterminating two entire packs of wolves in the largest wilderness area in the lower 48, the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness in Idaho. According to the lawsuit, the U.S. Forest Service illegally allowed Idaho's Department of Fish and Game to send the hired gun into the wild to kill wolves. According to Noah Greenwald, the center's endangered species director, hiring a bounty hunter to kill wolves in one of America's crown jewel wilderness areas just to make sure there are more elk for hunters to kill is one more example of the deeply sad, cruel, and reactionary nature of Idaho's management of wolves. Further, he states that this outrageous slaughter is a clear reminder of why all of our country's wolves need the protection of the Endangered Species Act. The Department of Fish and Game hired the bounty hunter in mid-December to pack into the 2.4 million acre wilderness to eradicate two wolf packs, the Golden and the Monumental packs, in the interest of pumping up elk populations for hunters. The Forest Service, which administers the wilderness, approved the extermination program by authorizing the use of a Forest Service cabin and airstrip. Yet according to the Department of Fish and Game, elk numbers in Idaho are at an all-time high. And although elk numbers have declined in recent years in the Frank Church, they remain healthy and are expected to increase with recent habitat created by fires. Thus, Greenwald states that killing these wolves has nothing to do with science-based wildlife management and everything to do with the anti-wolf attitudes of some hunters and the Department of Fish and Game in Idaho. Killing these wolves isn't just heartless, it's also a boondoggle. The center is represented by Earth Justice and joins a coalition of conservationists and conservation groups in this litigation. The conservationists assert that the Forest Service approval and facilitation of the program violated the agency's duty to protect the wilderness character of the Frank Church Wilderness. They have requested a court injunction to prohibit further implementation of the wolf extermination program until the case can be resolved. To learn more, visit biologicaldiversity.org.
The Animal Legal Defense Fund, along with several animal protection organizations, have sent a letter to the Dallas Safari Club denouncing their auction of a hunting license and export permit for a trophy-hunted African black rhino, a highly endangered species. The auction took place at the Safari Club's annual convention and expo in Dallas this weekend. The export permit is the first of its kind to be sold outside of Namibia. And the Safari Club's auction is the first in the U.S. to offer a chance to hunt an endangered species for sport. ALDF plans to closely monitor the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's issuance of the permit to import the slaughter rhinoceros and to ensure that the permit is proper. This week's convention is estimated to bring in proceeds of up to $1 million for the Safari Club. Although the group claims its primary intent is conservation of the critically endangered black rhino, fundraising proceeds from the convention consistently go towards hunting and political advocacy of hunting interests. International laws protect endangered animals in large part by decreasing the profit motive of killing and selling those animals and their parts. The Safari Club's auction will likely result in an increased exposure and big dividends for the group and convention sponsors and exhibitors, and could set a dangerous precedent for similar hunting clubs seeking to profit from selling rare permits to kill endangered animals. Due to past overhunting and poaching, only a few thousand black rhinos remain in the wild. According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the black rhino population has decreased by more than 90% in the past 3 decades. Rhino poaching often involves the use of tranquilizers to immobilize the animal and a chainsaw to remove the horn while the animal is still alive. During the trophy hunt made possible by the Dallas Safari Club's auction, Namibian trackers will guide the winning hunter to their quarry, where they can easily kill an animal the size of a car at close range in order to stuff him for display. The Dallas Safari Club should respect the intent of international regulations that attempt to conserve and protect endangered animals who should be preserved in the wild, not stuffed by a taxidermist for a Texan's trophy room. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Mark Reinfeld. He's an award-winning chef and author or co-author of 6 books, including The 30-Minute Vegan, The 30-Minute Vegan's Taste of the East, The 30-Minute Vegan's Taste of Europe, and now The 30-Minute Vegan, Soups On. That's coming up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Mark Reinfeld. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Hey, guys. I'm so happy to be here.
Mark, can you start out by telling our listeners how you got interested in being vegan?
Sure. Actually, I was on a kibbutz in Israel in around 1990, and I grew up in New York, and being on the kibbutz was the first time I got to see animals in their natural environment, and especially the baby cows had a strong impact on me. They looked just like dogs, and I just started making the connection, and I was also on the kibbutz. We were asked to transport the chickens into these crates to get slaughtered, and I was doing that for about 10 minutes, and I was a big chicken eater up to that point, and I just stopped right away once I realized I couldn't do that, and that began my journey into vegetarianism at that point.
It's interesting how some people can so easily cross over from just seeing animals in their natural habitats. And yet so many other people keep a blind eye to the whole situation.
Yeah, there's so many layers to it. And in my trainings and classes, I get to meet a lot of people. And it's just amazing to hear everyone's journey and how those layers peel away until, you know, you can look an animal in the eye and then just you make the connection and then it just falls away.
And that seems to be part of the problem, I think, today is we just don't have the opportunity to see an animal eye to eye very often. Our food is just so far removed from us.
Yeah, I remember I was in a natural food store with a friend's daughter, and we were in the meat section, and it came up that I didn't eat meat. And she said, why? And I said, 'cause I love animals. And she was like 4 or 5 years old, and she looked up to me with these big wide eyes and said, meat comes from animals? Like, she didn't even realize, you know, and that's most of us, you know, until we make that connection, we just lost touch with what the meat actually is.
I became vegan mostly for ethical reasons, for animal rights, but now I think I'm vegan just to annoy other people.
Well, I like to describe it as it's whatever reason you make become vegan is you, it's like walking through a door into a room, and some people it's the animal rights, some people it's the health, some people it's the environment, but then once you get into the room, you start learning about all the other reasons, and so they become your own. So now I'm fully embraced in the lifestyle, and all of the reasons are highly persuasive to me.
Well, speaking about the health issues, I understand you have a degree in holistic nutrition.
Yeah, I've been always interested in the connection between food and healing as long as I can remember. And so I was working as a chef, and I did a program just to strengthen that knowledge about how food can heal. And I really do feel that many of the illnesses that plague society are food related. And just by making these changes to your diet and lifestyle, we can eliminate not only the human suffering aspect of all these illnesses, but also the social cost that all of us bear for treatment of these diseases that are really easily prevented.
Well, I have a question about when you first began as a chef. Were you originally a vegan chef? Or because I've talked to people that are chefs, and you know, they say they want to be a full-time vegan chef, but their restaurant just can't make it, or there's not a place where they can work. So although they personally would prefer to be vegan, they find themselves cooking carnivore soup.
Fortunately for me, that my journey as a vegetarian and my journey as a chef occurred simultaneously. I always loved cooking as a child, and my grandfather is actually a world-renowned ice carver and chef. And so I always grew up with this kind of master chef in the family, and when I made that shift to vegetarian, I was actually pre-law, and I went to law school for a semester, and I realized that wasn't my path, and so I moved out to California, where I started working in a health food store. And basically, it was a vegetarian health food store at the time, so I was able just to explore creatively in the kitchen without pressure to include animal. At that time, I was vegetarian/vegan, and mainly a vegan at that point, but I didn't have to work with any, you know, dead animals.
Now, I guess speaking of holistic food and food that's associated with being healthy, one of the things that people think about is soup, and your new cookbook is the 30-Minute Vegan Soups On. Can you tell us a little bit about your newest adventure here in cookbooks?
Well, I'm publicizing this book as Vegan Soups for the Chicken Soul.
Yeah. So, that's good.
Yep. It usually takes a minute for that to sink in, but it's really basically like we don't have to have a comforting soup at the expense of the chickens, and the whole idea of chicken soup. You know, I grew up in a Jewish background, so I like the idea of just let's give the chicken soul a thought when we're preparing our soups. And the book is the fourth book in the 30-Minute Vegan series, and they're just quick and easy recipes. And the way I like to do recipes is what I call a template recipe format, where instead of actually showing you how to do one recipe, I show you how to break the recipe down to look at it as a template. And so each recipe actually contains hundreds of recipes within it. So there's really thousands of recipes in the book.
Can you give us an example of one of those templates, how it would work?
Sure. Like the example I like to give is this creamy broccoli soup, which is in the book. And when I do my classes around the country, I mentioned this also, I do soups on the first day. So basically the base would be, say, onion, celery, and garlic and water. And then, say, for a broccoli soup, the main ingredient would be broccoli, but you can replace that broccoli with cauliflower, zucchini, corn, potatoes, basically rotate through any of the different vegetables that you like. And then to give it a creaminess, the soup we blend with toasted cashews, but you can replace those cashews with macadamia nuts, hazelnuts, almonds. You can go into the plant-based milk, so like coconut milk, almond milk, hazelnut milk, soy milk, rice milk. Then once it's blended, you can add, the recipe calls for some herbs to add. So that recipe, say, has dill in it, but you can replace the dill with cilantro, basil, parsley. You can get in the realm of different ethnic soups, so Italian seasonings, Mexican seasonings, Indian seasonings. Just one of those components is going to create a new flavor for your soup. And then once the soup is blended, this recipe calls for some diced shiitake mushrooms to be added, but you can add other vegetables like corn or asparagus and rotate through vegetables there. So I'm not sure you're able to follow that, but basically that's how one soup really actually turns into hundreds of soups.
Yeah, it sounds like you have your stock that you use and then your main vegetable ingredient and then your spices.
Makes it easy for a trip to the grocery store, I think, too, because you can get all the basics and then build a bunch of different flavors around it.
Right. It's the idea of working with whatever ingredients are available. So when you see a recipe as a template, you could look at the recipe and say it's a broccoli soup, but if you don't have broccoli but you add cauliflower, and then you realize you could actually do that same recipe but just use the other vegetable.
Were any of these hard to fit into 30 minutes?
Virtually all of them are in 30 minutes. Some of them are a little more evolved, like, say, like a matzo ball soup, or there's some soups that I felt like I wanted to include, even though with the cooking time, the prep time would always be under 30, but sometimes the cooking time would go a little over, so I indicate those recipes that do go over, but virtually all of them you can prepare within 30 minutes or less.
I saw one soup that was a mole soup that you made the mole sauce from scratch. I'm sure that took more than 30 minutes.
I have to verify with the book, but it's coming close. Like, this is a simple tip, actually, is the idea of chopping as you go. So some of them, actually, you become more proficient the more you do the recipe and the more comfortable you are with the ingredients. So I was doing them in very close to 30 minutes, even ones that I mark as coming over 30 minutes. I understand people have busy lifestyles these days, so that's the whole idea behind the 30-minute vegan series.
I imagine your book's flying off the shelves now with this whole polar vortex, historic record storms across the U.S., and people being stuck at home for a long period of time. And soup is usually a winter month kind of food that people think about. What do you think are some of the best recipes for this time for all the people that are freezing?
The book actually is divided into different categories. So for the colder months, like going towards like the roasted vegetables or the roasted squash soups, there's a chili recipe, kind of the heartier, warmer soup. The soups that are good to bring you heat to the body are the ones that are, you know, you can gravitate towards in the winter. There is actually also a section on raw soups, which raw food cuisine is like the cutting edge of vegan cuisine, and so I have raw and dessert soups in there, and some soups I would do a cooked version and a raw version, like creamy tomato or Thai coconut or corn chowder. I would do a cooked version and a raw version just to show people the nuances of flavor. When I designed the book, I went through almost every fruit or vegetable I could find in the market and include it in the book. So pretty much anything you'll see in the supermarket, you should find a recipe for.
I've always thought that raw food cooking or preparation is more time consuming. Is that true?
Generally it is, though with these soups actually they are the faster ones. Like for the raw and dessert soups, they're basically, you're using a blender, so you're placing ingredients in a blender and blending and then adding other ingredients for texture and additional flavor. Mm-hmm. The raw food cuisine gets more time-consuming when you start getting into, like, dehydrating or sprouting or culturing, which is another technique in raw food preparation. So for the most part, it is more time-consuming, though for soups, actually, those are the quicker recipes.
Mm-hmm. And what about your other books? Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about them as well?
Sure. The first book I did was with Bo Rinaldi. It's called Vegan Fusion World Cuisine. We're looking to do a 10th anniversary rewrite on that. It came out about 10 years ago. And that book has a foreword by Dr. Jane Goodall and Sacred Site Photography by Martin Gray. And it's really a celebration of the world's cuisine, culture, art, and beauty. It's a coffee table book that's won several awards. That was the first book. Then we did The Idiot's Guide to Eating Raw through the Idiot's Guide series.
Sounds like a book for me.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have picked that name, but that was the name of the series. And then we went into the 30-Minute Vegan. So there was the 30-Minute Vegan. Then we did the 30-Minute Vegan's Taste of the East, which has recipes from all Asian culture. Then the last book was 30-Minute Vegan's Taste of Europe, which featured all European cuisine. And then the Soups book just came out a month and a half ago. And I'm currently working on a book now called Healing with Vegan Food. So it's going to focus on the healing, more on the healing quality of food. So really simple, few ingredient recipes that really emphasize the healing potential of plants.
Well, Mark, you mentioned that you have classes, so if you can't master the 30-minute recipes on your own, you do offer some classes. Do you want to tell us about that?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, the last 4 years or so, I've been traveling internationally between Hawaii, the West Coast, and now I'm in Florida, so I have on the East Coast some classes set up where I do 10-day trainings, 5-day trainings, 2-day workshops. And I also have an online culinary course that's available on through my website. And the idea for me is that a lot of people now have heard about vegan foods and they understand the benefits and they want to start including more of them. And a lot of people just don't know where to start or how to do it in a way that the food comes out tasting really good. So that's where I see my role in the vegan movement, is to just really show people how easy it is to create like world-class vegan cuisine so that they have the feeling of being satisfied and having really good food, so it doesn't feel like they're making any sacrifices when they, you know, want to pursue this for whatever reason.
How do you set one of these up? Say, I wonder if you're interested in setting up one in El Paso. How do you decide where you're going to have the classes? And
usually people approach me like someone who's on Animal Concern Radio or something would approach me to come. And basically I'm usually invited to a community and then would find a place that's suitable, a kitchen that can work. And then once we have that, then I have a good newsletter mailing list, and Facebook or social media and website is optimized. So that's usually how we start putting it out there.
And is it a 10-day class, did you say?
I like doing the 10 days the most because it really is life-changing for people. Like, people get very emotional at the end, and it's really a transformative experience to realize they can do it. Their confidence level increases, their skill level increases, and so I really like doing the 10 days, though people do get a lot out of the 5 days or the 2-day workshops, so if I were to come to El Paso, then I'd want to probably do it for a longer course just because I'd be traveling there. So usually I like to do like a 5 or a 10 day.
You know, reading your bios, some really impressive notes on there, and you've won lots of awards. I noticed one of them was vegan.com's Recipe of the Year Award in 2011.
I was wondering that too.
Yeah, what that dish was for.
That was another one of like my kind of core template recipes. It was It's a mouthful. It's a Mediterranean pistachio crusted tofu with a saffron quinoa pilaf.
Oh, wow.
And so,
that doesn't sound like a 30-minute one.
It actually, I mean, you can really do it in 30 minutes. You know, you'd have to work pretty fast on that one, but it's really a lot simpler than people think. And so with that, it uses tofu, and you can replace the tofu with, like, if you wanted to do soy-free, you can use portobello mushroom, and then it has a nut, the pistachio crust, but you can replace the pistachio with any nut or seed, and then it had a nice Mediterranean topping with artichoke hearts, tomatoes, capers, fresh Mediterranean herbs, and then a quinoa pilaf with some saffron in it. So that's usually my go-to dish to, maybe not that version of it, but doing some kind of crusted tofu cutlet to show people really what you can do with tofu is to kind of get over the tofu phobia.
There's still a lot of that around. You just mention the word and people's faces kind of like drop three layers, like, you're not going to make me eat that, are you?
Well, most people, their experience of tofu is like in a Japanese restaurant. It's that silken white tofu with no flavor or texture. So if you have a few bad experiences, it could really turn you off. So that's a lot of people are converted into tofu believers after having that dish.
I bet. And also, I just want to ask you real quick. We got a couple big holidays coming up. What do you recommend for serving on the Super Bowl?
Super Bowl. Well, the 30-minute vegan has some good like nacho recipes there. There's even simple things like just doing a really good guacamole or bruschetta. Those are some recipes in the Europe book. You know, a bowl of chili probably would be good as well, like vegan chili using tempeh. And that's where I would go with that.
Is the Super Bowl a holiday, Tom?
Well, I'll take any holiday I can get.
Yeah, I guess in some places.
I was going to say Valentine's Day, but I don't know if that some people don't think that's a holiday either. But any excuse to eat great vegan food is good
right.
with me.
Yeah, also, like, good recipe for barbecue sauce that you can do, like I like showing people how to do roasted tofu or tempeh like sticks, and then you could have the barbecue sauce, and that could be like a nice appetizer.
Mark, can you tell our listeners where to go to learn more about your cookbooks and also your trainings and tours worldwide?
Sure, thanks for asking. It's veganfusion.com, and if they can go there and sign up, we have a free newsletter where we send out recipes, and the website has a schedule and also a list of upcoming classes.
We've been talking with Mark Reinfeld, an award-winning chef and author of many cookbooks. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate you having me on the show.
If you'd like to learn more about vegan cooking here locally in El Paso, the Vegetarian Society is hosting a cooking class preparing vegan tamales on Sunday, January 26th. To register and for more information, go to vsep.org.
And we have a lot of events coming up at the Vegetarian Society of El Paso. I'll be the guest speaker on February 22nd to learn more about this event and other things we have planned, vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh for the Earth, the Animals, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.